So what memories did you have from four then, and where were you at the time?
Well, I just mentioned this one screen memory that I remember it from Portsmouth at the age of 15, 16, and then I leave to live in Vermont. So what it is I go through this door, and I'm quite shocked to see everything in the house. I think it's a house. White, everything's white. Everything is bright white. So I assume it's furniture. So I remember it as furniture, a man standing to my right. He was kind of vague. He was probably dressed in kind of beige, like beige color. And I assumed he was just a man. And the image I have, or the memory I have, he's an undertaker. Now, if I look back at my life in Portsmouth, there's no way that I would have been with a man in his house. I mean, it would be impossible, because I have no memory of that ever being part of my memory, and yet I really thought it was a real memory. So anyway, go back to 4 years old. I'm lying in bed, and I notice these flickering lights by the ceiling along the upper wall, and I think I was mesmerized just looking at them. And then I felt my body getting bigger and bigger and bigger, expanding into the room. I get slightly frightened. I didn't call out or anything to my parents. I got slightly frightened and put my head under the pillow. And in my mind's eye, I saw these entities walking around. And that was the image. And I always thought it was just a normal kind of maybe out of the body, or something was happening. But I didn't associate it at all with abduction.
What kind of entities?
I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't have any particular image.
And where were you living at that time?
In Oxford.
Well, bring it back to Prisoner Infinity. I mean, I'm sure you have picked up a lot by listening to the podcast.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that it's the usual conspiracy theory about UFOs, or even an unusual one, in that although it does have a lot of factual dot joining around different groups and individuals, the main thesis is more of a psychological one, which relates to early fragmentation and dissociation, and the relationship to these kinds of visions and interactions with apparent entities, and how the two seem to go together.
Right.
So anyway, I mean, that was just a preamble. But so what? How do you interpret that experience that you had at four now then?
Well, I mean, it's simply a memory. I don't have any negative effects. I don't have any traumatic effects. All my UFO experiences, six, have involved one of them was very intrusive, the one in Lawrence of Arabia's house, as it were. But no negative feelings about my family, no negative feelings about the past. I don't have any negative feelings about the UFO phenomenon, and I don't have it. I don't buy into the conspiracy theory. I don't buy into Armageddon. I think for 7 billion people to live on the earth and survive, and evidently, according to I think Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, that we're less violent today, and I think we've made a good job of it. So all these people that I'm probably going to meet on these interview programs are going to rave on about how, we're genetically engineered in the past, and how we're under the influence of AI, et cetera, et cetera. I have none of that paranoia, and I have none of that feeling at all.
Well, and why do you refer to that memory then as an abduction?
Well, because it, you know, that is what I've read. That's pretty much a scenario, but I don't necessarily care one way or the other. I don't care if I never see a UFO again. I don't care. I was speaking about Satori. I don't care if that never occurs again. I don't feel, you know, I think in the fact of living, you know, my everyday life, take the rough with the smooth, and most of my life in conventional terms has been very rough, you know, literally, physically and emotionally rough. But no, you ride the wave, and I don't need to seek refuge in those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were talking about, you pointed out the other day about when I was speaking about Krishnamurti and the altered state, you know, the state of beneficence, the state of immensity, the higher self, Satori, all of that kind of stuff. And when I said that I thought he was seeking refuge because he was groomed to be the Maitreya, he was groomed by the Theosophist Annie Besant and Leadbetter.
Mm-hmm.
So he loved that style. They brought him to London, Wimbledon, Common. He mixed with the aristocrats. His brother went to Cambridge. And he didn't want to lose that lifestyle. So when he quit the Theosophy Society in his late 20s, I mean, he had a massive following, he had massive amounts of property, and he still did when he died in 86. And so when I said to you about these people, you know, we're saying lying through their teeth, you know, I mentioned about Krishnamurti, and I could tell you quite a few things of the way he spoke to children, but because I had spent time at the school, etc. And, you know, I mentioned the word safe, and you seemed to kind of be alerted to that, you know, that he was seeking refuge and safety in this kind of split off part.
Hmm.
Or this, you know, he was a medium. I mean, as a kid, he had all these visualizations and everything, and that's what, you know, when he was in the Theosophy Society, he was only 15 when they picked him off the beach in Adiyavar, the headquarters of the Theosophy in India, and, as I say, groomed him and everything. And there were homosexual accusations against Leadbetter, who was taking showers with the two brothers.
And child abuse, even, with Leadbetter. I mean, he was diddling children, I think.
Yeah. He was an ex-priest, wasn't he? An ex-vicar.
I didn't know that. I didn't remember that. And how much older than Krishnamurti was Leadbetter?
Oh, quite a bit. He probably was 30s when he, probably at least in his 30s, I think. Much older. When he picked Krishnamurti up at 15.
Right.
But, you know, going back to the idea, which is interesting, of... I mentioned, I suppose I shouldn't drop names, but I don't have any kind of reservation about anything like that. I mean, people are people, and they deserve to be scrutinized. So I don't have any, you know, I've never read newspapers in my life or watched, you know, hardly any television or anything like that. So I don't play that game. And if you've got something to say, say it. And, you know, if it's honest and you want to know, you know. And so anyway, you know, the idea that if you confronted people that claim higher self and claim Satori and claim immortality and their pure love and all these ideal states of consciousness, which I think are just altered states of consciousness. Like Lily, I mean, Lily fed off the fact that he could take some drugs, he could be in deprivation tank and spend most of the day in an altered state, in an astral state, like Casey. And of course, I mean, you know, people love all of that. You know, you can be in a virtual reality, watch television, it's no different.
Mm.
And they get this idea at the end of the light at the end of the tunnel, near death experience, they've met these higher beings and everything, they're part of the avian, blue avians in UFO and all this stuff and all these entities. And I think, you know, my question is, who have you actually met, and have you really met the intelligence behind, you know, I think there's an intelligence behind the whole phenomenon of UFOs, and I wonder if any of these people have ever met an intelligent human, well, an intelligent being, you know, because everything they say is just ticking the boxes of the stereotypical New Age agenda. I mean, including the theosophists, it's just a kind of cult. I mean, it's an ideology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Seems to me.
Yeah, and I mean, there's two ways to approach this. I mean, you're talking about the individual, and I tend to focus on the collective. And I guess it depends who I'm talking to and when I'm talking. I try to focus on both. So with Strieber, let's say, I looked at Strieber, the individual, and in many ways, like you're saying, what I could see with Strieber was that he wasn't present in a way to meet anyone intelligently, never mind alien intelligence, that he was fragmented and traumatized, and it was there in the strain of his voice and everything else he communicated. So even if he had a true experience of the numinous or whatever, he misrepresented it so badly that it became untrue. And somehow toxic. I happen to think he didn't. I mean, one can't have an experience of the numinous if one isn't present for it, right? That's kind of what I'm saying. So, but that led to the discovery of more and more of how his very experience had been manufactured, and that he had been manufactured by the experience to become a manufacturer of experiences for others. Now, that's like a cult and an ideological machinery that we can trace back to the original fragmentation in a human psyche, whereby they're not able to connect to intelligence, but then expand outward and map it outward to groups and agendas and programs and, you know, documents and all the rest of it, a whole history of conspiracy, of social engineering. And that to me is very fascinating and very captivating, insofar as I see it as a way to expose what I call these crucial fictions that we create individually as a defense mechanism against trauma, but also which individuals are created to manufacture at a social level, ideologically and all the rest of it. So then the UFO is a crucial fiction, theosophy is a crucial fiction, it's all
right.
Yeah. So yeah. And if you're going to be doing interviews on shows, I mean, most of them, needless to say, won't be like talking to me. As you say, there will be these people, I mean, unless you're lucky and manage to find people who aren't banging one drum or another, they I mean, probably 80% of them are paid operatives at this point in the alternate media thing. But even if they're not, they've been sold a narrative, and now they're peddling the narrative, and it shuts down. I mean, that, to bring it back to your initial point, the possibility of intelligent connection between two awarenesses or two organic beings, you know, two organisms that are intelligent, connecting at that level of intelligence gets closed down because there is this manufactured agenda that's being pushed. And it's always the same agenda, right? It just takes different guises.
Well, I mean, Jung would say, he says that we only really know and experience our own psyche. I mean, the whole process of culture, language is contained within the psyche.
Mm.
So we don't... He does admit in his flying saucers that he thinks possibly there are actual craft from other planets, but he thinks basically the UFO is a mandala, a circle, archetype of the self, and is replacing the kind of Christ image in the what he called the age of technology. But he had one dream of a UFO is mentioned in Memory Dreams Reflections, his autobiography. And what he says is he's at his house in a dream. He's at his house on the shores of Lake Zurich. And these couple of UFOs fly around, and one comes right up to him and protrudes a lens. And he sees this as a magic lantern. And he says that magic lantern is projecting C.G. Jung, that he feels he's a projection of that fear, you know, that entity or whatever. And he says, we think we're creating them, but they're actually creating us. I don't know what that actually means, but that was his view.
Yeah, well, I mean, he also talked about the exteriorized psyche. I mean, that to me was a key term that he used, or lens by which to understand the UFO. Now, I mean, I'm not sure about Jung and the UFO because of his ties to MK Ultra and all the rest of it, and so on and so forth. But this basic idea of the exteriorized psyche, which I would relate to again to trauma and how the psyche isn't able to land and become fully integrated in the body because of trauma, so we're not able to experience intelligence dwelling, or immanent as you put it before, we're not able to experience intelligence organically like that. That does lead to the inevitability of some encounter with the psyche or the fragments of the psyche coming at us from the outside. And I guess we could say that the whole world is that when we're in this fragmented state, and we experience ourselves as this isolate awareness surrounded by a world that is other, when the reality is that I wouldn't say that all there is the psyche, but all there is perception, and the psyche is the way, the organ of perception, let's say, put it something like that, then yeah, everything that we are perceiving is in some way a reflection of the psyche.
And language. It's what we know, isn't it? The known, the experience that is actually conditioned by the language and conditioned by culture. So that's all we actually know. I mean, there's the real world of nature.
Language is an interesting, I think, an example of fragmentation, because language, we can see how it breaks down perceptual experience into fragments. I mean, literally letters and words that do not represent the thing they're describing, and then how that colonizes our thinking process. And I think we touched on this last time we spoke, that you did. You talked about, like, we can have an experience, you didn't say this, I'm paraphrasing, we can have an experience of existence as it is, but as soon as we report it, we languify it, then it's no longer the thing. Well, I mean, that's a platitude now, but that's because it's been languified too many times. But it speaks to this once again, that language itself is, I would say, is a symptom of fragmentation even, but it perpetuates it.
That's right. Because Gurdjieff said, you know, the multiple eyes, you know, that's really, you know, if you think of the process of conditioning, or as the Buddhists would say, then it's a matter of projecting multiple identities. And that, so we only know the world of other people as multiple identities. So the Mishkin type, the so-called idiot, comes back from Switzerland, you know, from some kind of recovery. We don't know why he went there, but Dostoevsky was an epileptic, so it's probably an autobiography like Crime and Punishment and the psychopath Raskolnikov. Mm. So he comes back, and the only person he can relate to is his uncle. So he goes to his uncle's house, and it's just a series of events where nobody knows what this person is doing, why he appears here, why he appears there, and he, you know, what they consider wrong decisions, for him are right decisions. And I mean, I found myself in not a dissociated state, but what Gurdjieff calls the most difficult thing for a person to, what he calls self-observation, you know, self-remembering, the most difficult thing, and Jung said it in his own way, that no, you can't analyze yourself. But what Gurdjieff said, most difficult obstacle is seeing your character, seeing your type. Of course, your character is imprinted in your body. So for Gurdjieff, who was a realist, not an idealist like Jung and Krishnamurti, for him to see himself in a karmic way would be to see his body imprinted with his character, his inherited character, in one moment. So, you know, you see, you know, so in the Satori state, in the state of no thing, nothing, when you see yourself walking by the river, and you are that so-called entity or that body, you know, and he said that was the most difficult thing that would block you from, well, I don't know what his term was, but Satori, you know. So in self-analysis, it's the Ouroboros just chasing its own tail, and it will never solve the problem.
Well, neither will Gurdjieff's fourth way, though, either. So, yeah.
No, you're right. Well, you know, I'm just, you know, pointing out the idea of, you know, what I mean, it's often said that the obstacle is yourself. Would you agree with that? The obstacle for...
I mean, I think it's, there's a sort of tautology, but also an oxymoron in there or something, an oxymoronic tautology. And I'm just speaking intuitively now, and I can't necessarily explain what I mean by that. But the more deeply I've come to experience my own fragmentation and this thing that you're pointing towards, that the only thing between me and reality is me, the more deeply I can experience that, the more I want to speak to trauma and the things that are done to the body, to understand or to help to assuage the tendency of self-shaming and self-blaming that is so endemic to spiritual teachings and disciplines, and is there also in this sense that we are somehow to blame for our own lack of enlightenment, you know, that we just need to get rid of this thing called the ego or whatever, you know, the self-reflection and self-regard and so on. Yeah, that's true at one level, but I think that it doesn't really help to know that or believe it or try and practice it unless we recognize how that guardian self that keeps us imprisoned and disembodied, how it came into form, and that we're not responsible for it, not even at the highest airy fairy new age thing of we chose our incarnation and all that, because that's also tautological and oxymoronic. Like, there's this base reality of infant or you know, newborn organisms being horribly traumatized by a dehumanized system, without there having to be any blame or recrimination in that, but just the sheer recognition of the reality of that. That happened to us at a bodily level before we formed an identity, and so an identity formed through that trauma, and that's the thing that keeps us in prison. So it's not really us, I guess, is my point. Summing up, that, you know, whatever it is that's stopping us, we might think that's the same thing we identify as ourselves, and that might be true, but it's saying it in a different way. It's misidentification, like we've misidentified ourselves as beings with a defense mechanism that was installed in us through trauma. And it seems it doesn't help to be saying, to be blaming that or identifying it as something that has to be removed. I guess I'm kind of reiterating what you said Gurdjieff was saying. Like, we can't pull out the splinter with our own fingers. We have to let the body do its thing, and it just naturally pushes that splinter out.
The slick and slimy feel of a wall that never peels. Humans use it all the time, well, good for them. I can't use mine, cause Julia's brains will plaster the walls. Julia's brains will plaster the walls. Natural selection made her hair like a rag doll's. Sewing up her lips at the man-made eclipse of her papa in the light of the hall. Come to plaster her brains on the wall. Julia's brains will plaster.
I think my own interpretation of thought and the psyche, which were big issues, thought for Krishnamurti and the psyche for Jung, I think the very, I won't use terms as if I'm saying that, you know, this is the cause of the problem on whatever level, you know, but dissociation, for example, is, I think, the state we're in, and we know it. And I use the term alone with the alone, which comes from Ibn Arabi, the Sufi poet or mystic. But so I'm saying that walking by the river and seeing yourself, you're seeing yourself in an integrated, holistic way, so that whatever that dissociation is, which carries the weight of the positive and the negative or the blame or whatever, you know, is not there. That's all I can say for me personally. Now, that's not the goal, so that you hang up your laurels on Satori. But that's the beginning. You let go of that and you start learning. So what I'm doing now, I would say, now that I've put all of, you know, I've individuated in the sense I've done my work on self-knowledge. I had my kind of satori, right? That process of 50 years of uphill struggle, the spiritual thing, all of that stuff. Now I'm beginning to learn. So putting myself through all this kind of conspiracy theory, talking to you, and this is all new for me. This is like going back to 22. I mean, I don't know where I am. I don't know what to do with what you're saying, you know. And so I'm really learning. And if you say, well, surely if you're at the end of the journey, the spiritual journey, the problem's solved. But no, in fact, the problem of the world is what I've got to deal with now.
Do you mean in terms of going out and speaking?
What the world's really like, I mean. No, not according to politics or religion or spirituality or satori. No, me as an individual, you know, an individual person now, you know, what am I going to do? I mean, where is my focus? What is the wound? What is the world? You know, what is a UFO? And really, you know, if you give me a map of the world, I don't know, you know, like the Mishkin character, I don't have a sense of belonging, so I don't even know what the issue is. I don't know what the issue is that is happening outside of the safety zone of spirituality, right? And I mean the whole of it. The whole concept of the New Age, the whole concept of the esoteric tradition, the whole concept of that.
So
there is another world. There is a real world out there.
Yeah, but it would seem that you've had an unusually direct encounter with that real world, including the spiritual groups and individuals and programs and all the rest of it. Like, it doesn't seem as though you've had a sheltered existence.
No, no, but that's a bubble, though. I mean, you can be the hero and go on your journey through the underworld, but what I'm saying is, when you close that book, that particular, if the scientists today closed that book, really closed in their head, they'd be in a different world. They'd be in a world they don't know. They, just as I said, at 22, I stepped into a different world. I'm not talking about a psychedelic or altered state. I'm talking about a different world. Right, and that journey that the you might say the unconscious, whatever, constellated or connected me to this so-called spiritual thing, living in a bubble, and I gravitated towards other people like Krishnamurti were living in a bubble. And now I've written a book on Jung, tried to expose that bubble. I finished that book, and you know, and I believe that, you know, this inflation, that if you pierce the bubble of your little isolated security and your belief structure, then you are in the real world. And that real world, and because my favorite is nature, so if that's the real world, then what is this human real world? I have no idea. I you know, because it's not philosophical, it's not academic, it's not spiritual. So what is it? Do you see what I mean?
I think I have a sense now, in which case it sounds to me like it's, well, that's liminality, crossing that threshold, whatever's on the other side of liminality. It seems, and I'm not sure if this is how you use the term about the cloud of unknowing, but it seems as though what you're describing would be a perpetual state of mystery and wonder and not knowing.
Well, let's put it this way. I've never been a psychological person, so it's quite easy for me to not be a psychological, therapeutic type person. So if you, in talking to you, if I say that I don't have an agenda, i.e. I don't have a belief or an ideology or even any particular fixed ego identity, you know, That sounds like I'm speaking, you know, R.D. Lang or something in the past, you know, that spiritual, you know, language or philosophy, but it's not. You know, I don't mean to say that. I'm a person, and, you know, today, you know, walking along, and I was thinking about how would oneself know that they're making contact with another self? How would you know that as a fact? And just as I was reflecting on that, and I heard a voice, and somebody called out, a young man said, oh, so-and-so, is that this the way to East Bridge? And I said, yeah, just follow the path. He said, oh, I've been walking so long, as if he didn't know, you know, how long he'd been walking and that. And I thought that moment of, say, intimacy, it was quite intimate, friendly, and that's what was on my mind, you know, at that particular time. You know, the layers of friendship, the layers of intimacy, the layers of belonging, the layers of security. So, you know, is it possible for two people to know, you know, you get married, you love somebody, belong to a family? I mean, everybody, all my family turned their back on me. And, you know, I thought I was loved in that family. And I was abandoned, totally abandoned in America, you know. So, but I don't have any negative feelings of the family, particularly. But I can see the mind game, the agenda, the mind game within the family. I was the youngest one, so I never learned the kind of group mind mentality. So I think they could just dispose of me without any feeling of responsibility, which they did. They did. So as I'm saying, as I say, in talking to you, and you bring up the kind of childhood, the trauma, I'm not saying I haven't been, and I'm reflecting on the fact for the first time that maybe I have been. So it's not like, you know, you think, oh, it's read R.D. Lang and read Jung and all of that. And why didn't he think of trauma? Or why didn't he think of his own childhood trauma? That's the isolation. If you go to Brockwood Park, Krishnamurti Foundation, or anything like that, forget it. I mean, you'd never be able to talk like this.
Right.
They would never allow it. It would be absolutely taboo. And that's just the outward, that's just like the reading of the Daily Mirror, you know. I mean, that's the taboo. Even that wouldn't be allowed, let alone, you know, taking off all your clothes in the hippie generation type of thing, you know. So when you say these things and I hear you and I think, God, I've got to speak to him, because what's going on? You know, I'm not aware of this level. I'm not aware of this language, and I'm not aware of people revealing and showing themselves. So, you know, it's a great thing. I think it's a great adventure for me. I'm not afraid of it. I really look forward to it, and maybe learning a bit of compassion and learning, not that through the eyes of charity and victim and, you know, forgiving people or feeling sorry for people in the third world or whatever. No, just learning about, you know, one-to-one conversation and what is this world we live in?
Yeah, well, I think that when you talk about if it's possible for two souls to connect and communicate,
yeah,
I really think that is the question that needs to be asked, and that it's certainly why I do this podcast, to explore that. Because, again, at a mind level and a level of language, I know that we can only ever know that we exist, that we can only ever be sure about our own awareness. We can't ever be sure that there's another out there to connect to. At a mind level. So that means there has to be a deeper level by which we can experience the other and a connection to it. And I also know that the prison that I talked about, which is the prison of identity, like the anguish and the pain of that, is of being totally disconnected and totally isolated from any kind of possibility of connection.
Yeah.
What seems to, I mean, the only way is that seems possible to me to begin to experience a connection to another is to begin to feel. Like, we have to be able to feel. Like, if we become dissociated and numb, the other could be there, you know, expressing all of this love in the world and absolutely being as present as they're present. But if we're not able to meet them there, we will still be isolated. It's not really up to the other or the world to find us. We have to find it, and to find it, we have to be able to feel it. So then, for me, it's been a process of allowing myself to become as vulnerable and as hurt and as wounded as I actually am, and to be able to express from that place, so that I'll be sensitive enough to feel the other in that place, and to be able to communicate.
So it's a kind of, you know, in a sense, the inhumanity to man, it's the humanity to man, you know, the person. So you're not humanism, but that's what I'm saying, you know. What is it? What is the world we're actually living in? What is it?
It's not
all that other stuff in books, and it's not the spiritual tradition, it's not Satori, it's not Buddha, it's not any of that. So I refer, probably the quaintest and easiest way to like express that is in the Zen poets. I don't know if you know the Zen poets, but they, you know, they're living alone, and they look out of the window and hear a monkey crying or something, and go in the kitchen, and he said Han Shan, and he comes in the front room, the sun's gone down, and he just puts his feet up and he says, I do that because I can, or I want to. And there's just this feeling of, well, it's a kind of resignation. You know, he's settled into his body, settled into the reality of the room. And he's not saying that's all there is, but he's saying there's no Zen, there's no Satori, there's no enlightenment. There's just old An Shan in the room. And, you know, I've met such a person. I've met a person uneducated. I've written about it here in Colchester. And he absolutely was that. And you know, if I've learned anything, it's certainly from him. But, you know, what am I to say? I mean, you know, in the sense of, without getting philosophical, you know, what is the world we're living in? What is it? You know, what's actually going on? So that's what I think we talk about.
Well, I think from, I mean, while you're speaking, what I get a sense of this world is that it's a human world, and the human is the traumatized animal. Like, a human being is like an animal that's been formed through trauma, or distorted or wounded through trauma, and has created a world that represents that. And so we're navigating that world, and of course we're looking for teachers and leaders and people who will teach us, who aren't traumatized, but they don't exist. And so, you know, because you've referred to a lot of different teachers and teachings in this conversation, and although I've certainly had teachers, and I don't dismiss the influence they've had, I think that really my true teacher is my trauma, and what I mean by that is that I think the only way to become whole, to become present, is to be able to hear what my body needs to express that it wasn't able to express because of the trauma that caused it to malfunction, let's say.
Can I ask you a question? You know, would you say that, you know, when you talk to me and I'm listening and I'm not saying I have or haven't a trauma, and if you're pointing that out to me, you're pointing it out to me, my view is, my feeling is, from my interpretation or my response is, to you saying that you know, you're it's necessary for you to be aware of trauma. Is it non-specific? Is it non-specific in your body, brain, mind? Is it localized anywhere, or is it non-specific?
Well, it's specific in terms of bodily symptoms. Like, I have specific bodily symptoms which I can trace and analyze and whatnot. And it's also specific logically in an event or a series of events in the past. But it's also general and universal.
Psychosomatic.
The symptoms would be psychosomatic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So there's a bleeding between the mind and body, and have you distinguished any, you know, if you think of childhood trauma, UFO, the whole complex, I mean, massively complex thing, the world is, and conditioning and everything, do you think you can isolate some level of cause?
For me, myself, individually?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in all this talk about, you know, psychology and trauma and everything, you know, what people go through, can you, you know, genuinely, if you, begin to unravel, you know, begin to contextualize the trauma, or is the trauma all pervasive?
I think... It depends if we're talking on what level. So it's all pervasive throughout the world, and of course there's no way to possibly unpack or turn that into a narrative. In my own life, and that's where my focus is, of course, whether I like it or not, it's possible to localize it or locate it, and to some extent narratorize it or narrate it, but, and I could talk about that more, but I think that that is just a way to get the attention onto the trauma that's in the body, and that doesn't need a narrative. Like the re-experiencing of the trauma, and the very thing that constitutes the trauma as it was, it's pre-verbal, it's pre-identity, it doesn't have a narrative around it, even though I could say in my own life it has to do at the very least with abuse by my brother that my mother ignored, at a much deeper, darker level, perhaps you know, organized abuse that my mother was complicit with, and who knows else was complicit with, and so on. And I have dreams, and I have this and that to map a very vague and uncertain narrative. All of that is just a way to keep my attention on, I mean, kind of paradoxical, on the present, because my present experience is of this dissociated state, this trapped state, this isolated state, where there's this strangled cry in the organism, and the organism, until it releases that cry, it can't just let go and be part of its environment and just flow and dance and be joyful and just live, because that cry is locked inside the body, and it's locking up all the muscles of the body. So to lead my attention, or to allow my attention to gently go deeper and deeper into the source of that anguish, so that I can re-experience it and release it. And that, it's actually very archetypal. Like, I've had many, many dream visions in which I experience myself as lost and abandoned by God, and that the only possible chance I had of reaching God and being heard by God was to find the deepest, most anguished part of me and to express from that part.
Is it kind of Kierkegaard?
Is it angst?
Yeah.
It may well be. I haven't read Kierkegaard.
Right.
But it's very existential. It's absolutely existential. It's like the primal scream, really, is like that.
I understand, yeah. So, you know, would you separate the psyche from the body? Would you separate the inner from the outer? Would you separate language from the body? You know, or is there some activity, let's call it a neutral word, activity, that affects the animal, right? Affects the animal. I mean, when we see the blackbird and stuff, it's just running about and it seems to be perfectly healthy. If it isn't, it probably will not survive. So we want to survive till, you know, we want to do our work, and that's, you know. So if you look at it from a neutral objective, or let's say neutral, not objective or subjective, but just neutral activity, that, you know, you see a stream and you see a piece of wood, don't you? And it's a light piece of wood, just a branch, and it goes down and it gets caught in the current, and it's just hanging on the edge of a boulder. You've seen things like that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that trauma is like that? Can you actually perceive that? It's a very simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see that? Not with a symbol. I mean, I'm using that analogy, but I'm saying actually know that. You know, actually, let's say live it, cognize it directly. Messages in shadows hid. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow. Horizon, I do hide the wind. Who rings the bells of happiness? Whose one invention is the end? Whose his messages in shadows here. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow.
Well, I mean, I can relate to the image, and I can feel a trueness about the image,
Well, can I bring in something else? You know Stephen Hawking, right? Stephen Hawking at Cambridge. And he's got this atrophy, you know, his body is just wrecked. I mean, his body is absolutely, so you can't even imagine the pain, the discomfort, looking at women, and he's got to like meet, you know, people. And he said that he would not swap his mind for a new body. Can you understand that?
Well, it depends what you mean by understand. I mean, I
Yeah, I mean,
guess.
can you empathize with him?
Well, there's different ways to look at that, though, of course, because that could be his identification and attachment to his ego, right? As opposed to just his acceptance that, you know, it,
The bird was, no, if you had the bird and you said to you put the bird in the golden cage, and it's a beautiful golden cage, of course the bird doesn't care, it wants to be out in the tree. So where is this freedom
It's
to walk
absolutely
by
inner. I mean,
the
it's absolutely inner.
Yeah, to walk by the river and be yourself. And you know the bird's individuated, the tree's individuated, the rest of the universe is individuated. We're not. We know that. We're absolutely not. We're not intimate with nature. We love to paint it comfortable, and these people write poetry and all the cultural embellishments. But in reality, you know, the man I met, he was absolutely natural person.
Well, except
Glad
that.
I discovered it. I'm glad I met. And he's not a Don Juan or a Krishnamurti, but he's what I felt I was maturing into, so to speak. So I did have a mirror, you know. He's died. And I get on with it, but and you know, the alone with the alone.
Yes. Well, the what I mean, what you're speaking to, or what I hear, and I think that. I mean, for a while, I thought you were going to ask me if I sensed trauma in yourself, or if I was speaking to something in you that.
Do you?
I do, yeah,
All right.
and I do try to speak to the person that I'm speaking to, and not just say what I want to say. I mean, that's the challenge of awareness connecting to awareness, to allow that to happen. And it is a challenge, of course, because we can't do it unless we're present, but we can't be present unless we do it. It's a kind of conundrum. So it requires allowing silence and loss, lack of communication and lack of connection and all the rest of it, and not trying to find the other. But it also requires something much more mysterious, which is connecting to the other within oneself. And so when we're talking, you and I, even though we're far apart, our bodies are connecting and transmitting in some way that we don't understand. Our bodies as organisms, we're relating as organisms before we're relating as mind. And it's very paradoxical, but
Well,
as
can
I,
I? Yeah. Well, you know, isn't, I mean, again, you know, as a species, we're relational animals, aren't we? Whether we like it or not. I mean, we're in relationship, even the astronaut's in relationship. He can't just cut himself off. You know, but we can be wildebeest. Or we can be a jackal or something, you know. But that's what I'm saying about what is the relational level, nothing to do with psychology, the relational level, when when we actually, you know, relay, I don't have an image of the world that we're talking about. I really don't, you know.
Well, are we talking about the world? I mean, we have been, but not...
I mean, your world or the other people of the world. And the learning comes, for instance, if I, you know, read a poem, you know, you're trying to discern the essence, the meaning, and the intention of the poet. And you're also seeing nature, and you're not just seeing a static picture, you're seeing a dynamic something. And what we were saying in the previous conversation about numinosity is probably everywhere. And has that got something to do with a new kind of relationship? See what, you know, because what the person that coined that term, Rudolf Otto, he wrote a seminal work called The Idea of the Holy, and he saw, he was talking about, you know, he's a religious person, but talking about God, and the numinous, he, the word he coined, refers to the holy other. So whatever the holy other, if it's the alien intelligence behind the conditioning, or if it's whatever's behind the psyche, or whatever you like to call the holy other, but so I would substitute for the holy other yourself,
the other within.
Well, just say yourself, me and you, existentially, me and you. Now there's no, you know, so I would say that the numinous is the threshold of yourself.
Okay, so when you said yourself, I thought you meant as in oneself, but then one's own self, yeah?
Yeah, so if a composer composes music and his intention is to, obviously he's in relationship, he communicates the music, whatever that music is, you sit down, it's not just vibrations, there's something going on, relational, that's being transmitted, being shared. You know, someone gives you an apple, you can survive. So it's aiding your survival. We you know, food for thought. We feed on culture. So we have to accept that. We feed on language, culture, all of that. But what I'm saying is the conditioning of spirituality completely distorts that. Philosophy distorts it. Every single system of knowledge distorts it. So you know, what are you saying? You know, and you're saying the key word for you is trauma. Is that the key word for me? I'd say the key word is numinosity. Right? So you're saying trauma, and I'm saying numinosity. Now, what does that mean?
Well, they're...
Do you see what I mean for you?
Well, they're synonyms, though. They are synonymous.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Is that... What is, you know, for Stephen Hawking with his body and his mind, what I'm saying is, we're talking, we're on this program, we think we know why we're talking together, but we only know through relationships. So you're saying to me, your keyword is trauma, my keyword is numinosity. Now I'm saying in the negative, say you listen to a piece of music, and in the it doesn't matter whether it's negative or positive. So I'm saying that maybe, you know, as I said before, I'm not interested in Satori. I've had bliss, but the last, when I finished the earlier program with you, I felt very ecstatic. And the other night when my friend went, I felt ecstatic, and I thought, my God, maybe I'm going to be happy. No, because I've been happy. So I was shocked at that, and the trauma of actually meeting all these people and exposing, you know, actually putting into speech what I've written about. You know, you could say that's a kind of trauma, but that's not a word I would use.
Well, I wouldn't use it for that either, though.
No, but it could be traumatic. You know, people have panic attacks and all different...
No, but that isn't trauma.
No, but you use the word... if you like, I'm saying.
Well, no, you can't, because that would be like saying a banana's numinous or something. Then you have to redefine your terms, right? So, I mean, one could talk about numinosity in an attempt to reclaim the word or, you know, give it meaning again. That would be valid. And so if I say that trauma is a key word for me, it's not necessarily because everything I believe revolves around the idea of trauma, but because it hasn't been understood, it hasn't been recognized. That could change, you know. And it also depend who I'm talking to and when I'm talking. I mean, it does seem to be a recurring thing, but and I said they're synonymous because they are, because, you know, what traumatizes us becomes numinous because it's larger than anything we can think about. And what is numinous is traumatic to us also as a constructed identity self, because we can't incorporate it into thought. So we can experience that as potentially traumatic. But I mean, the common thread there is something that we cannot process or assimilate into ourselves without letting go of the structures of identity to do so. And of course, that's the other in a nutshell. Like, you know, in a marriage, it's a constant struggle to retain one's sense of self while allowing for intimacy, and it never seems to quite work, because there's this ingrained terror of annihilation in all of us because of that early trauma. And yet it's what we're all seeking, is for union with the other.
What do you mean by the early trauma?
I mean pre-verbal and pre-identity. So like the massive shock to an organism of a brutal and, you know, sterilized birth process, even before that in the womb, if the mother is doing strange things. And then, of course, when it goes off the chart, as in my own case, probably when there is some kind of sexual abuse, violence, interference by, you know, dissociated adults who are compulsively reenacting their own trauma to try and get free of the poisons running through their psyche system and offloading them onto a helpless infant. Like something that nature never designed us to withstand, and yet somehow it has come to pass.
So, what comes to mind is, you know, the genesis and the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And so in the way I was speaking earlier, I would say for me, knowledge would be a poison.
Mm.
And wisdom would be whatever it is, the other.
Well, I think, I mean, when I referred to the other within, it just came to me, the phrase, for the first time talking to you today. But I feel we kept sort of circling around this notion that we can only really experience the other and know that they're real when we find them within us. And there is something within us that is other, and that is the source of wisdom and goodness and joy and well-being.
The self is the other for me.
Yeah, well, you can, that's a Jungian term for it, but of course that's a...
But you are yourself. There is no other, there is no God, there is no spirituality, and there is no safety.
Hmm.
I mean, no animal is safe. I don't feel safe. I said to my friend once, I walk up and down the river, I said, I'm taking a risk when I do that. And he kind of looked at me, didn't know what I was talking about. But, you know, the vulnerability, as we say, the Mishkin character that doesn't have a fixed identity. And it's not a fear, certainly for me, it's not a fear of somebody jumping out of a bush. But there is some room for a soul, whatever that might mean. You know, the Dostoevsky wrote a book, The Injured and the Insulted. But, you know, this vulnerability, and, you know, it doesn't bother me. And I don't feel I'm on guard when I'm walking. I look at the animals around me, and they're doing what they're doing. I'm taking a walk, and that's it, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's a risk in one sense.
Well, as you say, there's no guarding against it, because we could also receive an internal assault at any time. We could have an aneurysm, a stroke, a heart attack. Anything could happen, I mean, within reason, at any time. We're not assured of life and well-being from one moment to the next, of course. Animals don't have to worry about that because they can't conceptualize, and they have instincts. But we have instincts, but then we have this internal conceptual organism, whatever, that is able to conceive of danger, possible danger, when there isn't any, which can create a constant state of anxiety. But it can also lead to, I think, what you're describing, which is an absolute acceptance of the present moment and the uncertainty in the present moment. And there is freedom in that. I mean, like a kind of freedom that even the animals don't have, I think.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in the sense that I think something that's organic, for instance, you know, I used to love reading novels, 19th century novels, that stopped. I used to, you know, travel around, do this, that stopped. And now I don't read books, and I, you know, so I listen to a little bit of music. And apart from that, nothing else is going on. I have no inclination, no desire, no connection, no meaning, nothing with anything else in terms of culture. But I'm still relational, and I'm still a cultural person. I've got books, etc. I'm talking to you. But things stop of their own. I think they stop. Mm. So can you imagine whatever that is stopping for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, what I mean is, if you're unearthing something, is it with the intention of being free? Is it the intention of, you know, pulling the string, you know, kind of unraveling? Or does it stop sometimes of its own?
Well, I mean, there's stopping and there's stopping, aren't there? So I know how to relax and take time off, but the process is that it takes as long as it takes. Like, I don't have a say about the process that I am, let's say. I'm some sort of process of consciousness that has to run its course, and maybe when I can fully embody and accept that, then it will end in a way that you're talking about. I'll no longer have to add the energy of doing or of urgency or of intention to it, and it will just, you know, like I said, the body will push the splinter out and it will be done. Or maybe,
yeah, what I'm saying, Jason, is that I've said to you things have stopped, but the real world of people, Not through the lens of culture and conditioning, but the real world of people, like talking to you now, is a new experience, not only literally, but it is a new experience. Mm. And I don't know what you mean by trauma. Mm. I don't know what you mean by trauma. I don't know what is suffering, the Christian calls suffering. You know, what is that? I mean, I can label it, and I've been semi-depressed. I know people have been more depressed than I've been, etc. But I don't have a ready container for what you're talking about. I don't actually know what you're talking about. For you, I know the layers and you're trying to convey, and I agree, I'm quite interested in all this conspiracy theory, this new way of looking through the eyes of other people. And you know, I don't want to know. I don't have an idea of what the UFO is, and when you're saying trauma, I don't know how to internalize that.
Well, that's great.
As you're saying, if you're living it, then if I'm not living it and you're living it, I don't know what that is. I mean, you know, it might be like somebody else. You know, if you're depressed, it might be like somebody else.
Sure, yeah, well, that's great. So, I mean, that's great, because you can't, you know, one man's UFO is another man's dragon, and one man's trauma is another man's dissociation fantasy, and so on. So, yeah, I mean, you don't want to know what I'm talking about, do you? You want to experience it for yourself.
No, but I think it's one of those words which is very interesting to me, because when you say that, I can project that back into the family, into like the way Krishnamurti treated the children at the school, and the brainwashing and the indoctrination in interrogation that he put these people through, and Gurdjieff in his club and everything. And I can really follow that. I can kind of, you know, see all the nuances. But hearing you say it, and I think, my God, you know, what is that? Mm. Now, if I say to you, I'm in this state right now, are you interested or not? You know, are you interested in that? Which is much more difficult to express in a specific way, as trauma is like a very, very, you know, big thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's a massive thing. So if, for the Christian, what would they do without suffering, without the cross? I mean, what would they do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they didn't feel their suffering, my God, what would they do?
Well, I think that this can be continued on another occasion, because I think that you've led us to a question mark, which is a good place to end on rather than a full stop.
Yeah. Yeah.